Welcome, Curious Minds, to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a life that, well, it saw some incredible changes.
Absolutely. Imagine a world shifting from horse-drawn convoys
all the way to the space age. And the person we're talking about wasn't just watching.
No, he was right in the thick of it, commanding the biggest invasion ever, leading a nation through the Cold War. It's quite a story.
It really is. So today, our mission is to unpack the extraordinary journey of Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Yep, good old Ike. We'll explore pretty much everything. His beginnings, his military career across two huge wars.
His two terms as the 34th president, which were really transformative.
And the legacy he left behind, which is frankly enormous.
And to guide us, we've dug into a lot of material biographies, military accounts, presidential records.
We've pulled out the key insights, the stuff that really helps you understand the man.
Our goal is to give you a solid, but, you know, easy to grasp picture of how this one person navigated these huge challenges, defined an era, and made a lasting mark.
And we've found some genuinely surprising things along the way. Ike wasn't always the quiet figure people sometimes imagine.
Definitely not. Get ready to uncover some hidden depths. Let's jump right in.
Okay, so where do we start? Humble beginnings, really.
Right. He was born David Dwight Eisenhower down in Denison, Texas, October 1890. Third of seven boys.
But here's a little detail right off the bat. His mom, Ida, she actually swapped his first and middle names.
Oh. Why was that?
Well, his dad was also named David. So to avoid confusion, David Dwight became Dwight David. A small thing, but kind of sets the stage for his unique identity.
Makes sense. And they didn't stay in Texas long, did they?
No, they moved to Abilene, Kansas when he was very young. And Abilene was always the place he considered his hometown.
And the family atmosphere. I understand it was quite religious.
Very much so. His mother became a Jehovah's Witness, actually. Their home even served as the local meeting place for years, from about 1896 to 1915.
Wow. Did Dwight join?
No. Interestingly, he never formally joined that denomination or any church, really, until much later in 1952.
That's fascinating, given his later public profile. And his mother, Ida, she was against war, wasn't she?
Strongly pacifist, yes. Which is quite something when you think about her son becoming a five-star general.
Absolutely. But she had these history books.
Exactly. Full of military history, strategy, battles. And young Dwight just devoured them. That's where his interest really sparked.
So this contrast, a pacifist mother, a son fascinated by military history, how do you think that shaped him?
That's a key question, isn't it? I think it probably gave him a complex view of war. He understood strategy, the necessity, perhaps, but also the terrible cost.
You see that later, maybe with his hesitation about the atomic bomb?
Precisely. That deep awareness of the human toll seems rooted in those early days. Okay, so he goes through Abilene High School, graduates 1909.
And then there's this pact with his brother Edgar, right? About college.
Yeah, a classic deal. They take turns going to college while the other worked to pay for it. Dwight worked first, night supervisor at a creamery.
Showing that responsibility early on. But college plans changed.
They did. A friend suggested applying to the military academy's no tuition fees, you see.
Ah, practical thinking.
He tried for Annapolis first, but he was actually just a bit too old for the Naval Academy.
No kidding. So West Point it was.
West Point. Appointment in 1911. He apparently loved the traditions, the sports. Less keen on the hazing, though.
Can't blame him there. And academics.
Average, by his own account. Good at English, liked the engineering side. But sports, that was his real passion.
I read somewhere he said missing the baseball team was one of his biggest disappointments.
He did. Maybe my greatest, he apparently said. It's quite humanizing, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
He played football, though, right? Tackled Jim Thorpe?
Yep. Played halfback, tackled Thorpe. But then a knee injury in a later game basically ended his football days. Tough break.
So he pivoted. Fencing, gymnastics, still competitive.
Always competitive. That determination, you see it early. He graduated in 1915, middle of the pack.
But from the class the stars fell on. Amazing number of generals came from that class.
59 general officers, including Omar Bradley. Just incredible. Ike wanted to go to the Philippines.
But got sent to Texas instead.
Fort Sam Houston. General Funston. The Mexican Revolution was simmering. Just shows how chance assignments can change everything. Hashtag Chagrin War I and interwar period.
Okay, so World War I breaks out. Europe's ablaze. Ike wants in on the action.
Desperately wanted an overseas assignment, but nope. Denied again.
So what did he do instead?
He ended up commanding a unit training tank crews. Camp Colt, Pennsylvania. Brand new tech. Tanks.
So no combat experience in the Great War. Did that affect him?
Deeply. He was apparently depressed and bitter for a time, and later on, rivals like Montgomery would sometimes bring it up, try to diminish his standing.
Politics even then. But his stateside work was important.
Hugely important. He showed incredible organizational skills, setting up this massive training camp, figuring out how to use these new tanks, assessing personnel. He even got a Distinguished Service Medal for it.
So he honed different skills, maybe
Yeah.
logistics, leadership.
Absolutely. Skills that proved crucial later. But after the war, things slowed down for him career-wise.
Right. He went back to captain, then got promoted to major.
And stayed a major for 16 years, a really long time at one rank.
16 years. Wow. But he wasn't just sitting still during that time, that 1919 convoy.
Ah, yes, the Transcontinental Army Convoy, testing vehicles, but also highlighting just how bad America's roads were.
They averaged, what, 5 miles an hour across the country?
Something like that, a real slog, Washington, D.C. to San Francisco. And you have to think, that firsthand experience of crumbling infrastructure.
Directly planted the seed for the interstate highway system decades later when he was president. That's an amazing long-term connection.
It really is. He was also diving deep into tank warfare theory during this period.
Working with Patton, right? Pushing new ideas.
Yeah, they were advocating for faster, more offensive use of tanks. But the top brass, well, they weren't having it.
Too radical.
Consider too radical, yeah. Tanks were supposed to just support infantry. Ike even got threatened with court-martial for publishing articles about it.
Seriously. So he had to back down.
He did. A tough lesson, probably, in challenging the established way of doing things in a big institution like the Army.
But he was learning from some incredible mentors too,
Oh,
right?
definitely. Fox Connor in Panama, Ike called him the ablest man I ever knew. Studied Clausewitz with him.
Served under Pershing, MacArthur, George Marshall.
Pretty much a who's who of Army leadership. He was soaking it all in. And he excelled academically, too, graduating first in his class at the Command and General Staff College in 26.
So even though promotions were slow, this was a period of intense learning and preparation.
Absolutely, like a long, intensive apprenticeship. And his time working for MacArthur in the Philippines, that was particularly formative.
How so? I heard they didn't always see eye to eye.
They definitely clash philosophically. MacArthur was, well, MacArthur very autocratic. Ike disagreed on how to develop the Philippine Army, on leadership styles,
But clash of personalities.
and philosophies. Ike believed in more collaboration, independent thinking. Dealing with MacArthur's strong personality was probably invaluable practice for managing guys like Churchill, Patton, and Montgomery later on. Taught him patience, diplomacy, how to handle big egos. Hashtag, tag, tag, personal life nuggets.
Okay, let's shift gears slightly. His personal life gives you a different angle on the man.
Yeah.
He met Mamie Dowd in Texas.
Yep, while stationed at Fort Sam Houston. Whirlwind romance, really. Proposed on Valentine's Day, 1916, married that July because war was looming.
And like many military families, they moved around constantly.
All the time. Must have been tough, but probably strengthened their bond.
They also faced a terrible tragedy early on.
Yes, their first son, Dowd Dwight, they called him Icky, died of scarlet fever when he was just three. A huge blow.
And Eisenhower didn't talk about it much.
Very reluctant to discuss it, apparently. That private grief, maybe it connects back to his understanding of war's human cost.
Later in life, though, he found outlets, hobbies.
Oh, definitely. Golf became a huge thing for him. Joined Augusta National.
Didn't he have his golf balls painted black for playing in the snow?
He did. That's dedication. Or maybe just a general refusing to be stopped by conditions. He even put a little golf facility in at Camp David.
And painting. I heard he was quite the artist,
Look
too.
up later in life. Did about 260 oil paintings, mostly landscapes, portraits. Though he wasn't a fan of modern art, famously quipped it looked like a broken down car drove over the canvas.
Oh.
A traditionalist in art, too. What about cards? Bridge.
Yes. He was apparently a very sharp card player. Poker was a favorite from his Abilene days. And bridge, he was known as the Bridge Wizard of Manila.
The bridge wizard, that's great. But it speaks to his mind, right? Strategy, reading people.
Exactly. Those skills are transferable. It's said that being able to play bridge was almost a requirement for his WWII staff. He played constantly, even in the lead-up to D-Day.
It wasn't just relaxation then. It was part of how he thought, how he connected with his team.
I think so. Strategy, focus, camaraderie, all wrapped up in those hobbies. All right, let's move into the war years. World War II erupts, and Eisenhower's career, which had been kind of slow,
suddenly takes off like a rocket. He comes back to the U.S. in 39. Promotions start coming fast. Brigadier General right before Pearl Harbor.
And after Pearl Harbor. Big responsibilities quick.
Immediately assigned to the general staff in D.C., his job, figure out the grand strategy to beat both Japan and Germany. Huge.
And George C. Marshall spotted his talent.
Marshall had an incredible eye for talent. He saw Ike's organizational genius, promoted him to run the operations division. By June 42, Ike's back in London, commanding U.S. forces in Europe, A2SA, getting ready for the invasion. Hashtag, tag, tag the North African and Italian campaigns. Operations Torch and Avalanche.
Then comes North Africa. Operation Torch, November 42. He gets the top job, Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force there. Natusa.
A massive command. And significantly, he was the first non-British person to command Gibraltar in 200 years. Shows the immense trust the Allies placed in him.
But it wasn't smooth sailing initially, was it? The French situation.
Oh, that was a nightmare. A preposterous situation, as one account puts it. Rival French factions, Vichy collaborators.
And he made that deal with Darlin, the Vichy official.
He did. A purely pragmatic move, he argued, to save lives and get troops moving into Tunisia.
Yeah.
But politically, hugely controversial. Allied leaders were furious.
A real baptism by fire in wartime politics and diplomacy.
Absolutely. He had to make a tough, unpopular call for military reasons. Darlin was assassinated soon after anyway, and Ike appointed General Giraud.
But Torch was also where he learned combat command, right? Made mistakes.
He admitted it. Said he was indecisive during the Battle of Kasserine Pass, where Rommel gave the Allies a real drubbing. He interfered too much.
But he learned fast.
Very fast. Got better at delegating, removing underperformers, adapting strategy. North Africa, then Sicily, then the invasion of mainland Italy, Operation Avalanche.
Which was brutal.
Yeah.
Germans outnumbered them initially.
Yeah, the Germans reinforced heavily. It was a tough, grinding campaign. But all of it, North Africa, Sicily, Italy, it was essential preparation for the main event. Hashtag tag Operation Overlord and the invasion of Normandy.
The main event, D-Day. December 43, Roosevelt picks Ike over Marshall for Supreme Allied Commander in Europe.
An incredible responsibility. He's now in charge of planning and executing the Normandy landings, liberating France, invading Germany, everything.
And the pressure wasn't just the enemy. Managing the Allies themselves sounds like a huge challenge.
Maybe the biggest challenge. You had Roosevelt, Churchill, de Gaulle, Admiral King, Montgomery, Patton. Huge egos, national interests, strategic disagreements.
He argued with Roosevelt, threatened to resign over air command.
He did. He insisted on unified command of the air forces for the invasion. And when Churchill initially resisted, Ike basically said, fine, get someone else. Churchill backed down.
Wow. And managing Patton.
That was a constant balancing act. Patton was brilliant, but volatile. Ike had to reprimand him, sideline him at times, but knew he needed his fighting ability.
So how did he keep it all together? How did he get these powerful figures pulling in roughly the same direction?
It was his unique skill, wasn't it? Part diplomacy, part firmness, part sheer force of personality and the weight of his office. He listened, he persuaded, but when needed, he gave the order. Unity was everything.
And he connected with the troops too, right? Visited the divisions before D-Day.
Made a point of it. Shook hands, talked to them. He felt the human cost profoundly. Which makes that note he drafted even more powerful.
The in case of failure note.
Yeah. Saying the decision to attack was his, the troops did everything they could, and if any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone. Just incredible ownership.
Yeah.
Hashtag tag liberation of France and victory in Europe. So D-Day is a success. They establish a beachhead. But then comes the long slog across France.
And more command challenges.
Yeah.
Monty wanting priority, Bradley wanting priority.
Constant juggling. Ike insisted on retaining overall control of the land strategy, managing supplies, mediating between his ambitious field commanders. It was complex.
Did it slow things down, that debate?
Some argue it might have. But Ike's steady hand kept the Allied effort moving forward, eventually opening crucial ports like Antwerp, which was vital for supply.
And he gets his fifth star in December 44, General of the Army.
Recognition of his leadership, his diplomacy in holding that coalition together. He commanded respect, even from guys like Zhukov, the Soviet marshal. They apparently got on quite well.
Then the Battle of the Bulge, Germany's last big gamble.
A nasty surprise counteroffensive. But Ike reacted calmly, repositioned forces, used air power once the weather cleared, and broke the German attack.
As the end neared, there was pressure to race the Soviets to Berlin, wasn't there?
Huge political pressure, especially from Churchill. But Ike refused. He stuck to the agreed-upon demarcation lines with the Soviets. Berlin was in their zone. Military objectives first, political glory second.
A controversial decision then, maybe, but probably strategically sound.
He wanted to avoid unnecessary conflict with the Soviets and focus on defeating the remaining German forces. And then, as the concentration camps were liberated...
He ordered them documented.
Yes, extensively. Photos, films. He foresaw the possibility of Holocaust denial and wanted undeniable proof. He even made local Germans tour the camps, a powerful act of ensuring historical truth.
Okay, VE Day. War in Europe is over. What's next for Ike?
He becomes military governor of the American zone in Germany, based in Frankfurt, for about 6 months. Huge task, dealing with the devastation, millions of displaced people, POWs.
And he made some changes to policy there, regarding German POWs.
He did. He reclassified them as disarmed enemy forces, which technically took them out from under the Geneva Convention protections. It sounds harsh, but paradoxically, it allowed for more flexibility.
How so?
Well, it bypassed some rules, but he also worked to bring in massive amounts of food aid for civilians and eased up on the strict non-fraternization rules. It reflected a shift toward seeing Germans more as victims of Nazism while still pursuing denazification efforts, a pragmatic approach.
Interesting nuance. Then he heads back to Washington.
Yep. November 45 replaces Marshall as Army Chief of Staff. Big job. Oversee the massive demobilization. Millions of soldiers wanting to come home. Not enough ships. Logistical nightmare.
And during this post-war period, we get that really striking insight about his view on the atomic bomb.
Yes. He privately voiced his opposition to using it against Japan, said it wasn't necessary to win the war, and he hated for the U.S. to be the first to use such a weapon.
Coming from the Supreme Allied Commander, that's incredibly significant. It speaks volumes about his perspective on warfare's limits.
It really does. He initially hoped for cooperation with the Soviets, even visited Warsaw, was shocked by the destruction. But by mid-47, with tensions rising over Germany, Greece...
The Cold War is setting in.
Exactly. He reluctantly accepts the containment policy as necessary. A big shift from hopeful collaborator to Cold War strategist, hashtag tag the reluctant candidate, the call to politics.
So he's a national hero, hugely popular. Politics must have come calling early.
Oh, yeah. As early as 43, people were suggesting he run for president. He apparently threw one guy out of his office for suggesting it.
Believes soldiers shouldn't seek political office.
Strongly. He turned down appeals from both parties repeatedly. In 48, he flatly said he wasn't available, couldn't accept a nomination.
Even Truman offered to help him run as a Democrat.
Truman did, or offered to run with him if MacArthur got the Republican nod. But Ike stayed unaffiliated. People thought he'd missed his chance, assuming Dewey would win and serve two terms.
But the pressure didn't stop. What changed his mind for 52?
Two main things, I think. First, the growing Draft Eisenhower movement, a genuine grassroots swell of support that made him feel it was a duty.
And second,
his opposition to Senator Robert Taft's isolationist foreign policy. Ike deeply believed in NATO and international cooperation. He saw Taft as a threat to that and felt he had to step in to offer an alternative for the Republicans.
So it was a sense of duty and a specific policy concern.
Pretty much. He declared himself a Republican in 51, resigned from NATO in June 52, and hit the campaign trail.
With that killer slogan, I like Ike.
Simple, effective, unbeatable, really. He won in a landslide against Adlai Stevenson in 52, first Republican president in 20 years, won again easily in 56.
Last president born in the 19th century, and the oldest elected since Buchanan. Way back. Quite a unique path to the presidency.
Before the White House, though, there was that interesting detour. President of Columbia University.
Right. 1948 to 1953. Not exactly a natural fit, was it? Mm-hmm. The five-star general and the Ivy League academics?
Reports suggest it was not a good fit for either party. He apparently didn't have much common ground with the liberal faculty. It must have been some awkward faculty meetings.
I can imagine. But he wrote his memoir then, Crusade in Europe.
He did. And it was a huge bestseller. And he got this incredible tax ruling.
Oh, yeah? What was that?
The Treasury Department ruled he wasn't a professional writer, just selling his unique life experiences. So he paid capital gains tax, not income tax, on the massive advance. Saved him a fortune.
Wow. Only Ike could get a deal like that. But Columbia wasn't just a holding pattern.
No, he used it for what he called political education. Started study groups, founded the American Assembly to discuss policy issues, and crucially, the fundraising he did put him in touch with influential people who later backed his presidential run.
So kind of accidental political groundwork.
In a way. Then, in late 1950, he takes leave from Columbia to become the first Supreme Commander of NATO.
back in uniform, back in Europe, building up the alliance.
Turning it into a real military force, a credible deterrent. So Colombia and NATO, they were this unexpected but vital bridge from military leader to statesman, ready for the Oval Office.
All right, into the White House. January 1953. What was his core philosophy? He had a name for it.
Dynamic conservatism. Or sometimes the middle way. He saw himself as a progressive conservative.
Meaning, what did that look like in practice?
It meant he wasn't an ideologue looking to dismantle the New Deal, for instance. He was fundamentally conservative fiscally, wanted balanced budgets, but accepted popular programs.
Like Social Security, he expanded that, right?
Yeah, he did, adding about 10 million more workers to the rolls, rolled it into the new Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And he privately warned Republicans that trying to abolish it would be political suicide. Very pragmatic.
He also beefed up the National Security Council's role.
Yes, made it much more central to Cold War planning. And he used press conferences extensively, nearly 200 of them, saw it as talking directly to the people. #tag key domestic achievements and challenges.
Okay, domestic policy.
Mm.
What stands out, for me, it has to be the highways.
The interstate highway system, absolutely. Championed it, pushed it through Congress, signed the Federal Aid Highway Act in 56.
And the justification was national defense.
That was the key argument, yes. Needed for moving troops, equipment, evacuating cities in a nuclear war scenario. But the real roots go back further, don't they?
To that 1919 convoy and seeing the German Autobahn during the war, it's amazing how those experiences coalesced into this massive project.
It truly reshaped America's landscape and economy, a monumental achievement.
Then there's the response to Sputnik. The Soviets launched that satellite in 57. Huge propaganda win for them.
And Eisenhower reacts decisively, creates NASA in 58, signs the National Defense Education Act.
Pumping money into science education, math.
Exactly. Mm. He understood national security wasn't just missiles, it was brains, technology. He also created ARPA, which eventually led to the internet. Quite the scientific legacy for a general.
What about civil rights? This was a period of growing tension.
He made his opposition to segregation clear early on, finished the desegregation of the armed forces that Truman had started, used the power of the purse government contracts to push it through.
Signed the first Civil Rights Act since Reconstruction, too.
1957 and 1960. They established a civil rights division in the Justice Department, gave the federal government more power to fight voting discrimination. Modest steps by later standards, but significant at the time.
And then Little Rock, 1957. Governor Faubus blocking integration.
And Eisenhower sends in the 101st Airborne, federal troops, enforcing a court order in the South for the first time since Reconstruction. A huge symbolic moment.
Martin Luther King Jr. thanked him for it.
He did, called it courageous. But it's important to balance this with the darker side.
The Lavender Scare.
Yes. His executive order, 10450 in 1953, fueled the persecution of gay and lesbian federal employees. Mm. Thousands lost their jobs based on sexual orientation, which was conflated with being a security risk, a communist traitor, a very dark chapter reflecting the prejudices of the era.
Definitely important to acknowledge. What about his relationship with Congress and McCarthy?
Well, he only had a Republican Congress for his first 2 years. Dealing with McCarthy was tricky. Ike initially avoided direct confrontation, worried it would just give McCarthy more oxygen.
But he did eventually act.
When McCarthy went after the army and threatened White House staff, Eisenhower invoked executive privilege in 54, denying McCarthy access. That was a major blow that helped bring McCarthy down.
Though some criticized him for not defending George Marshall earlier from McCarthy's attacks.
Yes, that was a point of criticism. On the courts, he appointed 5 Supreme Court justices. Most notably, Chief Justice Earl Warren.
Who ended up leading a very activist, liberal court on civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite what Ike expected, maybe.
Probably not entirely, but Ike respected Warren's integrity. His presidency also saw Alaska and Hawaii become states.
And then there were his health scares.
Yeah.
Pretty serious ones.
Very serious. He quit smoking cold turkey in 49, but suffered a major heart attack in 55.
And the doctor initially misdiagnosed it. Tried to cover it up.
Yes, Dr. Snyder downplayed it, even altered records to make Ike seem fit enough to run again in 56. Then came surgery for Crohn's disease in 56 and a mild stroke in 57.
Wow. Running the country through all that must have been incredibly stressful.
Immense pressure. And it certainly factored into his decisions, his energy levels, maybe even his choice not to seek a third term, though the amendment prevented it anyway.
Okay, let's turn to foreign policy. Top priority coming in was Korea, right?
Absolutely. The war was stalemated, costly, Ike visited Korea after being elected, saw the mess firsthand.
And he ended it pretty quickly once in office. How?
He basically made it clear, through diplomatic back channels, mostly to the Chinese, that if an armistice wasn't reached soon, the U.S. might expand the war, possibly even use nuclear weapons.
A credible threat.
Apparently so. An armistice was signed July 53, divided Korea roughly where it started, still in effect today, a huge achievement for his administration.
His broader Cold War strategy was the new look.
Yes. Less reliance on expensive conventional forces, more on nuclear deterrence, massive retaliation, and using the CIA for covert action.
Like in Iran and Guatemala.
Exactly. CIA-backed coups in Iran, 53, to restore the Shah and protect oil interests, and Guatemala, 54, to overthrow a government seen as too leftist and threatening U.S. companies. Controversial then, even more so now, but standard Cold War practice at the time.
Then the Suez Crisis in 56. Big test.
Huge test. Britain, France, and Israel invade Egypt after Nasser nationalizes the canal. And Ike comes down hard on his allies.
Condemned the invasion, forced them to withdraw using economic pressure while the Soviets were crushing the Hungarian uprising.
Right. He condemned the Soviets too, but took no action there. It was a principled stand against aggression by his allies, upholding international law, but it strained relationships.
And led to the Eisenhower Doctrine.
Yes, pledging U.S. aid, even military force, to stop communism spreading in the Middle East. He used it to send aid to Jordan and troops briefly to Lebanon in 58 to stabilize the government.
What about Southeast Asia? Vietnam.
He continued aid to the French against the Viet Minh, but crucially refused direct U.S. military intervention at Dien Bien Phu in 54, said it would just suck U.S. troops into an unwinnable war. Prophetic.
But he did form SIADO and increased support, including advisors, to South Vietnam after the French left.
Yes, he deepened the U.S. commitment, setting the stage for later escalation. It was all about containment. Same with the Taiwan Strait crises.
Threatened nuclear use against China there, too.
Implied it, yes. Maintain strategic ambiguity to deter a PRC invasion of Taiwan or the offshore islands. Kept the peace, but ratcheted up tensions.
And the space race. Started slow, but Sputnik changed things.
Dramatically. Led to NASA, NDEA, the focus on science. He also established the nuclear triad bombers, ICBMs, submarines for deterrence. Though privately, he thought the race to the moon was nuts. Way too expensive.
Always the fiscal conservative underneath. Until the U-2 incident blew up.
May 1960, U.S. spy planes shot down over Russia. Ike initially denied it, then had to admit it. Hugely embarrassing. Torpedoed a planned summit with Khrushchev. A sour note near the end. So his second term ends. He's the first president affected by the 22nd Amendment. Can't run again.
Endorsed Nixon in 1960, though not always enthusiastically in public. That famous gaffe about needing a week to think of a Nixon idea he'd adopted.
Ouch. Kennedy's campaign loved that one. But his most impactful moment leaving office was arguably his farewell address.
January 1961, the warning about the military-industrial complex.
Yes. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence by the military-industrial complex. Coming from him, the five-star general, the war hero president.
It carried immense weight. And it's only become more relevant over time, hasn't it?
Absolutely. A profoundly prescient warning from someone who understood the system intimately. After leaving office, Congress actually reactivated his five-star rank. Unique honor. #, #, post-presidency and death.
So he retires. Where did he spend his time?
Split his time mostly between his farm in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, right next to the battlefield, and a home in Palm Desert, California.
Stayed out of the limelight mostly.
Relatively, yes. Yeah. Although he did address the 64 Republican convention, supported Goldwater, albeit perhaps with some reservations.
And he lived for another 8 years after leaving office.
Until March 28, 1969, he passed away from congestive heart failure at Walter Reed Hospital, age 78.
His last words were quite moving.
Reportedly, I've always loved my wife, my children, and my grandchildren, and I've always loved my country. I want to go. God, take me.
He lay in state at the Capitol Rotunda, then buried back in Abilene.
In a simple government-issue casket, wearing his WWII uniform, alongside Icky, his son, who died young, and later Mamie. A soldier's burial, really. #, legacy and historical assessments.
How do we view Ike now? His reputation has shifted, hasn't it?
Massively. While president, he was incredibly popular, approval ratings consistently in the 60s, sometimes 70s, but right after he left office.
The view soured a bit. Compared to Kennedy, he seemed, I don't know, less dynamic.
Exactly. Critics called him inactive, uninspiring, the golf-playing president. faulted him for not doing more on civil rights sooner, not confronting McCarthy publicly, the U2 mess, letting the Soviets seem ahead in space.
But then historians got access to his papers, took a longer view.
And the assessment changed dramatically. Revisionist historians started highlighting his hidden hand leadership, his effectiveness behind the scenes.
Now he's ranked pretty highly, right? Top 10 often.
Consistently. Praised for ending the Korean War, avoiding new wars, managing the Cold War without blowing everything up, strengthening alliances, keeping the economy stable, balancing budgets.
Rescuing the Republicans from isolationism, getting the interstate system built, pushing science, and yes, making crucial, if sometimes cautious, steps on civil rights. And that military-industrial complex warning looms large.
One historian called him a political genius for making incredibly difficult things look easy, keeping the public calm during very tense times.
He also left some practical legacies in government structure.
Formalized the White House chief of staff role, modeled on the military system, that's standard practice now, and the up or out policy in the military.
And his name is literally stamped on the landscape.
The interstate system officially bears his name. The Eisenhower dollar coin, tunnels, buildings, Fort Eisenhower now. A national memorial in D.C. finally dedicated in 2020.
It's quite a turnaround. From being seen as slightly dull to being recognized for these profound, lasting contributions.
A complex legacy, but one that looks stronger and more significant as time goes on. Hashtag tag outro.
Well, that was quite a journey through the life of Dwight D. Eisenhower. From Abilene to West Point, through World War II, Columbia, NATO, the White House.
He really was at the center of so much 20th century history. What stands out most to you, looking back?
For me, it's that ability to manage immense complexity. Whether it was Allied generals or Cold War crises or domestic politics, he had this capacity to synthesize, to find a path forward, often quietly.
That hidden hand approach, balancing strength and diplomacy, pragmatism alongside principle, it left a huge mark.
It really did. So for you listening, what's your key takeaway about Ike's leadership? And here's a final thought to chew on.
Okay.
Eisenhower, the ultimate military man, warned us about the military-industrial complex. Given everything he knew, everything he saw, what deeper insights might he offer us today about balancing security and liberty, about managing that complex he knew so well?
That's a powerful question to ponder. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.
Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep digging deeper.